Podcast today's show at rte.ie/todaywithseanorourke.
As you probably know, a number of treatment options are available to people who find themselves facing up to mental health issues. I'm joined again in studio by Professor Jim Lucy, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. He's also Medical Director at St Patrick's Mental Health Services and the author of In My Room, The Recovery Journey as Encountered by a Psychiatrist. Jim, thanks indeed for coming back, and you're going to tell us some more of the stories in that book. You're here today primarily to talk about the value of conversation, getting to a situation where a patient can talk frankly and openly about the causes and effects of mental distress.
That's right. We're here, thank you very much, Sean. We're here really to talk about the idea of talking about mental health. For so long, we didn't talk about it. And for so much of the time, it was behind closed doors and hidden behind walls. And what we're saying now is that really this conversation is worthwhile. It's opening up the doors, but it's also opening up the opportunities for recovery.
Once people start talking, how long a journey is it before they can really be truthful and honest with themselves?
It varies very much. It depends on what issues there are, what engagement obstacles there are, the fears of the past, the guilt and shame that's part of our makeup, that sometimes is part of the burden of illness, the anticipation of the future, and just simply the fear of actually addressing painful issues. All of those things in different mixtures and different settings can impede what really conversation brings us, which is engagement.
How often would it arise, Jim, where you'd be talking to a patient where they would think they were telling you everything, but you would know from experience, I suppose, and your training and expertise, there's something there you have to keep maybe poking at, and eventually it gets there?
Well, sometimes it's a real joy to get there, isn't it? But very often it's clear from the outset that we're not talking about the real issues. One of the stories here that we might be talking about is Owen's story, who came with a depressive illness, who came with problems at work. He'd stepped down as a deputy headmaster, and it was all too much for him. And he'd even been treated for depression by his GP, but it wasn't depression, and there was something entirely different that emerged. And this does happen a lot. His story is a remarkable one, but yes, you're right. It's that uncovering that happens because of the intensity of the conversation in the room or with your therapist, your counsellor, that allows things that weren't said elsewhere be said now.
Now, you mentioned in the notes for this that Owen has morbid jealousy syndrome and alcohol dependent syndrome. So how do you get to the heart of that?
Well, I mean, when we went through it, he was describing himself as a man of moderation in all things, who just was a bit overwhelmed. He needed to get to the gym. He needed to get diet and exercise and all these good things right. And they were good things. But his depression didn't attach itself to anything until I asked him about his home, about his family. And then he revealed to me that his wife was having an affair. He was absolutely certain of this. And he said he was convinced he was going to actually have to expose this. She was a colleague of his in the school, and he was going to actually expose this to the school managers and indeed expose her lover, who was a colleague. Now, this was all very dangerous. And so at that stage, I was concerned for her. What would happen to her? He was accusing her. The conversation was always at home about his feeling of righteousness and her defence for herself.
Oh, and was this a fact-based narrative that he was giving you? In other words, was it true?
But we didn't know at this stage. Part of the, I suppose, the exposure of the conversation is that neither of us knows the truth at the outset. We both travelling that journey together. I didn't enter into confrontation with him, but I asked him whether I could speak to his wife. And I was concerned for her because I was concerned for her safety. Jealousy is a major factor in actual domestic abuse. And domestic abuse is a big problem in Ireland and an underestimated problem. She came in and she made it quite clear that she was not having an affair, that she very much wanted her marriage to thrive. And she said, but you do know Owen is an alcoholic. And at that stage, I had to bring him back and say, well, you haven't exactly been truthful when you described yourself as a man of moderation, have you? and the whole story unfolded. And it unfolded in a way which wasn't about confrontation, but was about the disclosure in a context of complete sharing of integrity, of honesty.
So what explained his belief, presumably it was a belief, that there was an affair going on? Was it the alcohol dependence, or was it the alcoholism, or was it this morbid jealousy?
Well, the morbid jealousy is a rare consequence of the poison of alcohol in his brain. He actually acknowledged that during periods of abstinence, he didn't feel jealousy. And one of the things we don't acknowledge about the mental health challenge of alcohol, we've no truth telling about alcohol and its mental health challenge in this country anyway. Culturally, we're unable to acknowledge that mental health and alcohol are hugely linked. But when he experienced that and went through periods of abstinence as a part of his journey to recovery, it became clear that he wasn't jealous when he was sober. But when he was drinking, he became enormously overwhelmed with the fixity of view that she was having an affair.
When he wasn't drinking, did he believe she was having an affair?
No. He knew she wasn't having an affair when he was sober. He couldn't believe it when he was drinking. We forget that alcohol has a direct chemical effect on the way in which our brain works. And this is a classic example. Alcoholic jealousy is a classic example of the kind of thought-altering nature of alcohol.
And it was the alcoholism that was causing the morbid jealousy syndrome.
Absolutely,
in this case.
Absolutely.
So, How did he work his way through that? How did you help him?
It was extremely difficult for him because he had to share with two things. He had to overcome the sense of shame and guilt he had about what he was doing to his wife and his children and the way in which he had distorted their relationship. But he also had to overcome his craving for alcohol and acknowledge that he had been binge pattern drinking for many years and that had been part of the pattern of his decline in his function at work and in other relationships. And gradually, but with huge effort on his part, he entered into AA, he started coming to counselling more regularly, and we addressed his other issues in terms of his relationship and tried to build a pattern of behaviour which would help him overcome his craving, which was a big factor.
So this was partly dealt with by conversation. Was there medication required?
At the outset, no. Later on, he did take for a time a medication to reduce his craving, but that was actually only a brief period of his recovery, and one which hasn't been part of his sustained progress. He continues to be well.
Now, you want to tell me as well about a man with bipolar mood disorder, again, something we hear a lot about, Andrew.
Andrew is a remarkable man. He came to me one day with a referral from his GP, the first time I'd seen him, saying that he didn't actually have any problems at all. Again, coming back to your point of how often is it the case that when you're talking in this conversation, it's something quite different that actually emerges from it. He had no problems at all. The GP was mistaken. And in fact, he said he'd heard of me and he wanted to share with me an opportunity, a business opportunity, an opportunity to develop a whole new prospect for software development. Obviously, something which, Sean, I can tell you, I know nothing about. At that stage, I was fairly well alerted to the fact that this was not a conversation about reality. But Andrew was a very ordinary person with a very obvious real life, wife and family, a job and all the rest. He suddenly announced that we couldn't have a conversation in my room and we had to go for a walk. And he took me at a great pace along a long walk, between Patrick's Hospital and the Christchurch Cathedral. And we ended up having our consultation over a conversation in a coffee shop at the corner of Francis Street. At that point, he became explosively alarmed because I wouldn't go along with the development of his software company. It was clear he was in a manic state.
Is bipolar disorder, bipolar mood disorder, always accompanied by mania?
Yes, bipolar mood disorder is, by definition, a condition in which there is at least one manic episode. And mania is three things, really. It's alarming increase in mental activity, alarming increase in physical activity, and alarming distortion of judgment. So there's this tremendous energy, which meant that he couldn't even sit in my room. We had to go for this walk and we were at pace. And also the thoughts, which were grandiose and ill-judged.
In that situation, I imagine the question might arise in people's minds listening to us, Jim. Would you ever feel afraid?
Yes. Yes, no, that does happen, and you do have to be aware that you have to be cautious, and you get to learn how to manage confrontation, how not to seek it, how to remain calm, how to de-escalate in a sense. In other words, in that situation, for example, it wouldn't have been wise to say, no, I insist you sit with me in the room. I went with it. We went for the walk. There was no harm done. But it was an alternative to alarming confrontation.
So how did you bring Andrew around?
Andrew was very disappointed that I wouldn't go along with this. And in fact, he stormed out of the coffee shop and left me with the bill for a large number of buns and a lot of tea. But the story didn't immediately end well. He actually quite suddenly turned. His mood dipped and he made an attempt on his life, which thankfully he survived. And at that point, and that's often the case, at that point he did agree to treatment. He was in despair, and he has made a great deal of recovery in his own story, which is, you know, we describe in the book. Is he says that in his illness he was in a nightmare, and in recovery he was in reality.
And how long did that take then?
That took about 3 months, actually.
Presumably a combination again of conversation and medication.
Yes, he was briefly in hospital after he attempted to take his life. I mean, I suppose people don't realise that the value of having that communication is something that's holistic and something that has its own dynamic, and people can engage with it at their own pace. Quite quickly, he realised that it was in his interest to make a recovery.
How can people know, maybe listening to us, whether something that may be going through their mind, they may think they have a great idea, and oftentimes it is.
Absolutely.
That's how people become millionaires.
A spark of genius.
Maybe with software projects. So how can you tell whether, look, this is an idea that's worth pursuing? It may even to the point that other people might regard as obsessive.
Yes.
But how can you distinguish that or know that that's okay, and as opposed to something that is really, you know, off the scale?
It's fanciful and off the scale. It's these three things that I tried to hint at that shows really about how the brain works. See, a healthy brain integrates our functions, our motor functions, our thinking functions, our social functions, and keeps them in balance with each other. So when they are in balance, even the most fanciful scheme might be worth pursuing, but it's not illness.